Is the learning in your school competency-based? Is it personalized? Is it happening anytime, anywhere? Is it student-owned? In other words, is the learning student-centered? And are all students learning more deeply, more equitably, and becoming career and college ready? If you have these questions, want to know what the research says about them, and are trying to figure out how to implement these ideas in your classrooms and schools, you've come to the right place. Thank you for listening to the Student-Centered Learning Podcast. I'm your host, Arthur Barriff, and I've been a principal and teacher in student-centered schools for over 17 years, and I can't wait to share a story or interview that will help you help your students. Today we continue a series of very special episodes, 15 interviews of student-centered educators brought to us by guest producers. You're about to hear from Lauren Bedell, a graduate student in Providence College's Urban Teaching Program, who interviews Dr. Anthony Rodriguez, a third-timer on the podcast, and who's assistant professor in the Elementary Special Education Program at PC, and a teacher of over 20 years working to create equity in his classrooms through a student-centered approach. They talk about mastery-based education and other student-centered learning concepts. Enjoy the interview.
So, tell me a little bit about yourself, Dr. Rodriguez.
Sure. I am assistant professor of education here at Providence College. I've been here for, this is my sixth year, and I specialize in mathematics education and special education.
Nice. Okay. With that, I know you were teaching in New Mexico for a little while.
Yep.
So tell me about that. What made you move from New Mexico to here, and what influenced you most while you were there?
Yeah, so I taught there for 13 years, and I taught both in kind of deep urban areas of Albuquerque, New Mexico, and in the most rural parts of New Mexico on a reservation called Zia Pueblo. And what influenced me to come out here is I wanted to kind of influence the next generation of teachers. I wanted to just have an impact on more classrooms than just one, because I was noticing that, you know, the one classroom I was teaching was great and I enjoyed it a lot, but I also noticed that a lot of classrooms around me were crumbling and not doing as well as I would like.
Yeah, I remember those stories from what you did with your high schoolers and moved up with them every year, seeing all of that progress with them for math.
Yep.
One of the biggest things you focus on is mastery of a subject.
Mm-hmm.
Ensuring students have mastery of concepts, not just running through the curriculum, and really getting them to where they need to be.
I noticed my first few years, and I think a lot of teachers do this, is they follow what's given to them and they follow what the school's doing, and I think that's really important. So I was working through, I believe it was Everyday Math program back in, I think, the late 90s. And I noticed that, you know, my students were compliant, my students were respectful, my students worked hard, and they just didn't have a lot of the depth of knowledge. They didn't understand how to solve problems in different ways. I think they could do it exactly the way the book taught them, and when they came to these like eight boxes where you had to do like eight different things at the same time, they would crumble. And I noticed that no matter how clearly I explained it, no matter how many different models I showed them, they were still having a hard time with the curriculum. And I started noticing that it might be the curriculum. It might be the actual structures that I was given. So I decided to go off the curriculum a little bit, and the more I went off the curriculum a little bit, the more I found that my students were engaged. Could have been because I was more interested, I don't know. But all I knew is that it was getting better. Their test scores were going up, attendance was getting better. There was a certain vibrancy in the classroom that I wasn't seeing before. And when I started to see that, I just didn't turn back. And at the same time, I was also becoming a whole lot more interested in teaching.
So is that where you started implementing more student-centered learning?
Yeah, absolutely. Especially with a lot of my students with disabilities, they need more reps. They need more opportunities to attack the problem. And I think with a lot of curriculum, if you're not done with a certain concept in 2 or 3 days, you're done. You're done. You're moving on to the next thing. And that does not give them, even students without a disability, I don't think it gives them enough time to really know what they're doing. And it encourages you later to have a ton of review time, have a ton of those like speed test-taking stuff that students are doing right now. I think they go from beginning of March through whenever they're supposed to take the standardized test to just do a lot of review over and over and over again. When my students took that test, we didn't need that stuff. We were constantly reviewing. And the great thing about project-based learning is that there's so many different concepts and skills that tie into one project that review is natural and it's not forced. And I think that in a classroom, if you're spending more than 10 minutes of review time, you're going to lose your class real quick, because they start to say, oh, we've already done this. Why are we doing this again? It's like, well, we all need a little bit of review, but not, you know, half an hour of let's go over our homework problems from last night type of stuff.
Yeah. I think I remember you telling me there's no point in spending that time in the beginning of class going over the homework.
Mm-hmm.
Because then when you go over the homework the whole time, you're wasting class time. And yeah. That's when they can really be learning from the teacher.
Absolutely. Yeah. Sometimes what I've noticed when now that I'm in a different position, I see how classrooms are run. And I notice that a lot of that homework time is actual time when the teacher is taking attendance, you know, doing the lunch count, doing organizational stuff when, you know, that stuff should be done before. I mean, that stuff should not be done during instructional time. If you're doing that, you're not optimizing the learning in your classroom, for sure.
So going back to when you said you knew you wanted to move from just being effective in one classroom to having an impact on others.
Mm-hmm.
What really drove that home for you and made you think about that? Because you had a big transition coming to PC.
Yeah. Yeah, that was probably the toughest transition I think I've ever had, going from teaching students to teaching people how to teach students. And yeah, I struggled a lot both getting here. I think it, you know, it's what, 2,000 mile, you know, move.
Yeah,
different,
that's huge.
Different, you know, place to live, different, you know, culture up here. Although I am from New York, so I totally remember what it, you know, what New England is like. Yeah, it was hard because when I would mentor teachers in New Mexico, they would watch what I did. They would see what I did. They would see how my classroom worked. And I didn't have to explain a lot of the finer points of it, because they saw it in action. They saw that it was working. I didn't have to sell it. Here I had to sell it, because they didn't see if it actually worked. They had to see it for themselves. So I had to be very patient in teaching the skill, having the students work on the skill, and then having them try it out on their own. And then, you know, it could be months before they came back and said, you know, I think that worked. And I think patience was the number one thing I learned coming out here and working with student teachers, is just knowing that, you know, you may never know what your impact is until a while later, or maybe not at all.
Do you have a favorite PBL you've done, either in New Mexico or here?
Yeah, I think on the reservation, my favorite PBL was when we built benches and we learned the finer points of measurement and built in some numeracy and some estimation into that and some basic geometry. That was a really cool project. And at Siebel High School with the high school students, we had an integrated composting program, which I think was really cool to understand curves and understand the heat distribution of a compost pile. And basic quadratic equations, I think, was awesome for that. And, you know, I was just thinking back to a minor project-based learning on gravity and how my students wrote word problems using, you know, the gravity formula. And I read some of their stuff, and it cracked me up. It literally cracks me up, where, you know, one of my students, like, broke up with her boyfriend that morning, and she's, like, mad at him, so she calculated the trajectory of her shoe, like, throwing it at the, with horizontal and vertical acceleration, all this, and the impact of gravity on the shoe, and how it, is this, or it, so as her boyfriend's running away from her, you know, and tries to get into a helicopter, and the helicopter is a certain, you know, amount of feet above her, will the shoe hit her boyfriend? Will it miss the boyfriend? At what point will the shoe hit the ground? And she drew the picture, and she had the whole formula out there, and she calculated it all down, and then she played around with some of the variables for the upward forces, and it was brilliant. It was brilliant and hilarious and totally appropriate. And I think that's what project-based learning is about. It's about something that they care about so deeply. It impacts them at a deep level. She was pissed at her boyfriend. She was like,
yeah,
he must have done something stupid. She wouldn't tell me what he did, but and she's like, yeah, I'm totally making this do a math problem. I'm like, cool, we'll do that. That's good.
I mean, that shows mastery in itself, that she drew it out, she figured it all out, she made it personal. She really got it covered.
Yeah, oh man, she was so funny. She's like, oh, I got this. I've got this. I'm like, really? You have a problem? She's like, oh yeah. Oh yeah, he's getting hit with that shoe.
A different kind of problem there.
Yep.
What you've mentioned, like briefly, like results you've seen with student teachers. What's the biggest driving force in? Because it's scary going into a classroom, and some of the other courses I've taken, since I've had a few with you,
mm-hmm.
but some of the other courses I've taken with different professors, they don't really, it's stick to the curriculum. It's don't venture off, it's stick with this, and all the support you need is in this one textbook or
yes.
guide that the district provides you, and it really doesn't give you much feeling of freedom, especially as a new teacher. I know going into student teaching, it was, I'd ask my cooperating teacher, I'd be like, can we slow down a little? My students aren't getting it. Like, I see mm-hmm. it. I think they just need me to break this down a little more. Like, I've only finished half the lesson for the day. Can we finish the second half tomorrow? And it's like, nope, we got to keep going with the yes. curriculum.
Yep. Yeah, I think that you're hitting on kind of the heart of why, personalized learning is so important, and why social emotional learning is so important, is that if you're like, no, I gotta go, the student's gonna be like, okay, then I don't matter. Like, your curriculum matters more than I do. And anytime that your curriculum matters more than they do,
they are not motivated.
They're done. Yeah, they are not gonna show you their best stuff.
And that comes into effect in higher grades, because mm-hmm. they've had so many years of just being shoved under the rug there's a huge gap there.
Absolutely. And the other thing, when you get asked questions in class and the teacher or the professor is like, no, we got to go, we're done. Like, can't answer your question, we got to go. That also says, okay, please don't answer it. Please don't ask me any more questions in the future. And a lot of times students tell me that they feel like they can't ask questions in classes because all the professor wants to do is get their content done that day. And it doesn't matter, hell or high water, it's going to get done. And I think same with patience in, learning how to teach here. I think it was important for me to learn how to be patient in a day-to-day fashion with you guys, and to understand that you guys will get this. You guys will absolutely do very, very well. I just need to be better at understanding, what's getting in the way of you doing your best work right now. Instead of saying, no, I'm going to show you three times. If you don't get it, I'll show you a fourth time. Don't get it, I'll show you a fifth time. You better know it by the sixth time. It's like, no, it's not that you can't get it. You'll get it on the first time, if I understand how you learn best. And I think that I tried to do.
You did very well.
Thank you.
Of course. You told us really the importance of supports.
Mm-hmm.
But that was never what came first. I just remember sitting in class and the outline being, we're going to address this topic, or what topic is most important to you. You normally helped us out a little bit because we're like, I don't know what's wrong, what's right.
Yep.
So then you went into us going in deeper, and supports were never the first thing, but it still promoted equity for all of us. So mm-hmm. how did that work at a classroom level for you?
So yeah, I would always have a plan. Like, I'd always have a plan on what I thought we would do that day and what I thought the trajectory of the class would go. And I timed it, as you saw on the board. I had little timings. This is going to take 5 minutes. This is going to take 10 minutes. This is going to take all this time. But
which was a very nice thing to have. I miss that.
So it keeps. I needed that to keep myself on task. But I also knew that I also built it so the 10 minutes. I knew I had maybe 2 or 3 minutes in there. That if something else needed more time, I could spend that time and not feel like I needed to rush you guys through stuff. And it gave me just enough structure where I can feel. Feel free. Like, I think structure can lead to freedom. It's just with those curriculums that I learned at first, they were too structured, where I felt like I was in a straitjacket. But as far as the schedule that I put on every day, it gives me just enough structure to do good work, but not too much structure where I feel like I'm in a straitjacket. And I think that's really key for young teachers, especially, is normally your first 3 years will kind of determine what kind of teacher you're going to be. And also determine whether you want to be a teacher for 25. And if you feel like you're in a straitjacket for your first 3, you burn out. That's why we lose so many teachers, is they literally don't see teaching as a creative art and as a as just a really cool thing to do. They see it as, okay, well, I should be on chapter 5 today. I should be on chapter 5.3. I better be on that tomorrow. And if I don't get that done, and then you have all this anxiety building in the teacher, which transfers to the students. And I learned that early, like, to keep my, and everyone feels it. Everyone feels the pressure. Everyone feels a little bit of anxiety, but to try to kind of flush that out before I saw the students. So when I was with the students, I could like flush the anxiety out of them and make them feel more more themselves in the classroom. Because I see that, especially now, I think if you go into classrooms right now, a lot of teachers are so stressed out that their students feel it.
Yep, I would agree. Especially state testing mm-hmm. doesn't really help. Teachers not so directly, but still imply opt out when it was first implemented, at least back in New York. So yeah. That was something that it's more on them feeling that stress and how am I going to get all of my students to perform.
Yeah, and the states should be taking the stress off the teachers, but if the states and the districts don't, you know, take those things off them, then it's our job to make sure it doesn't hit the students. Mm-hmm. And it's sad that we have to be the leaders in that when really our bosses should be taking the, I mean, that's the definition of a good boss. A good boss should be taking weight off of you so you can be an optimal employee. It's like a, I don't know, I guess with your father's in the police force, you think of like a good, you know, sergeant, you know, can take the weight off of a patrolman so the patrolman can do their best job. And that's what I would like to see with, you know, leadership is that they take the weight off a teacher so teachers can do their best job. And I haven't seen a lot of that since No Child of Mine came in a long time ago. It's been all on teachers, and that's too much.
You also mentioned, I think you mentioned it so briefly one time, that you were considering taking a sabbatical year to go back into the classroom.
Yeah.
I forget nothing.
No, you don't. That's, yeah.
You think you'd still do that?
I would love to. If Providence College gave me, the next sabbatical, so, you know, if I get tenure, I think I'll get one in 4 years.
Okay.
And yeah, no, my goal is to apply to a, like a school district and just work there for a year.
So if it's just a year, do you think you would feel trapped under the different curriculums that they had? Or do you think you would dive headfirst, feel comfortable enough to go back to implementing project-based learning on a younger level?
I'm ready. Yeah, I think I'm ready. I think when I left my high school job, I had it dialed in pretty clearly, so it was one of those things where you keep failing, and then finally you build like the perfect, you know, monster. And I think I had pretty close to a good monster. Then I'm hoping that I can sell that monster to the school, whatever school district it is, and say, this is what I want to do. I totally understand if you don't, you know, want to do this, but, you know, if you hire me out, this is what I want to do. Does it sound good to you?
I think that might be a little sad for them if you get 1 year of great scores and then all of a sudden you're gone.
Then there's the other part. Like, a lot of me wants to go back.
Fully?
Yeah, I think I really like this job. I like working with you guys a ton. I just hope that the structure here changes to the point where we can do better. And right now, there is a lot of
change needed.
Yeah, I would say yeah.
Yeah.
So I think that has to happen.
And lastly, do you happen to have any resource, whether it be a book or an online source, that you would recommend?
A good book you guys read last fall. It was Building a Better Teacher by Elizabeth Green. I think that's a good one.
That really focused on mm-hmm. the nitty gritty of it.
Yeah, like the history of education, like what, you know, good teachers do, what pedagogical content knowledge is, and yeah, I think I think if superintendents read that, they could see that there can be a balance of rigor with freedom.
And not having rigor be like a negative trigger word.
Yes.
I've seen that.
Oh, yeah. No, it's almost used only as a, that's a great point, it's used only to criticize.
Yeah.
Like, instead of saying, wow, I like the rigor of that classroom, they're like, oh, I wish that classroom was more rigor.
Yeah.
That's all it's used for is negative.
Yeah, so maybe putting a more positive spin on it after mm-hmm. reading the book.
Yeah, that would be a good one.
Awesome. Well, thank you for your time.
Hey, thank you. Good conversation.
Thank you again for listening to the Student Centered Learning Podcast. Let us know what you think about this episode or what you tried in your school by commenting on our Facebook page. You can also subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher, and please leave a rating so others can find us. You can also follow us on Twitter at STUCNTR Podcast. And remember, students learn deeply when they are at the center.